This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech at friendsintech.com.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
Scott McCloud.
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama. This is the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. If this is your first time listening to Technorama, thanks for joining us. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. I'm Craig Stepp, and for my co-host Chuck Tomasi, we present you a special interview with Scott McCloud. If you're not familiar with Scott McCloud, he is an author, writer, and webcomic artist. Scott McCloud has made some time for me to do a little interview for Technorama, and I certainly appreciate it. How you doing, Scott?
Oh, I'm pretty good, Greg.
Yeah, so you're in Rock Hill, South Carolina this week, and you're traveling around talking about, material in your book and understanding comics.
I'm just talking about anything that comes to mind related to comics. This is a Making Comics tour officially, but any subject is fair game.
Right. So for anybody that doesn't know who Scott McCloud is, can you give us a little background about yourself?
Well, I've been a cartoonist making comic books since about 1984, and I'm probably best known for a series of books about comics, starting with Understanding Comics in 1993. And that one was more or less how the medium works, how we read comics, how we understand process, that sort of thing. And they're in comics form. So they're big, fat comic books about comics. Also known for talking a lot about comics and technology, do a lot of public speaking. I did a series in the 80s called Zot. So a lot of different aspects of the comics form.
Mm-hmm. And you've done some writing as well, because I have a soft spot for Superman. And when I saw that you had done some writing for Superman, I was like, oh boy, I got to talk to him about this. So can you give us a little background on what you've done on Superman?
Sure. I've handled Superman a few times. I did 12 issues of the kind of all-ages Superman title back in, I guess it was the late 90s, called Superman Adventures, which is based on the animated series. And that was a lot of fun. I got to start from the very beginning, and it was after the series had just started. So it was like getting to write Superman the first time, you know, without 40, 50 years of continuity to weigh you down. I was able instead to just treat it as a brand new character and play with some of my ideas for what that character could do. That was a lot of fun. I also did a Justice League issue, and I wrote a three-part Superman story called Strength, which came out just a few years back, and that was a sort of three-part graphic novel.
So on a Geek Factor, I had to have been a lot of fun to do, though.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. My first choice usually is to write and draw my own stuff, but there are some things that I don't feel like my art is necessarily up to the challenge on, and that's a lot of modern superhero things I don't think I do quite as good a job at. Although I'm trying to get better. That's my latest book, Making Comics, is in part trying to teach me to be a better cartoonist, because there's some stuff that I'd like to be able to draw of my own, some stories of my own I'd like to draw, and I want to make sure that I'm good enough to draw them.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's funny you mention that, because I've been, like I mentioned before, I'm a closet cartoonist, and I've just started putting some comics on my website very slowly. But I'm starting to experiment with it, you know, doing strips. And I'll talk to you about experimental comics in just a little bit. But when I heard you were coming, I saw the book. I went and bought the book. And I was impressed that it was in a comic form. I mean, that was a page turner. I was like, oh, this is really cool. I've never seen a thick book like that, you know, but it helped me understand things like you were talking about, especially the hand gestures, when you were talking about that hands up and hands down and facial expressions. I liked a lot about that. So how does that really help you? I guess doing the research?
Well, doing the research and also trying to work on my own art. Like when I'm talking about facial expressions, body language, or credible backgrounds and things, I can't talk about that stuff without demonstrating it.
Sure.
Because that's what you do. If you're doing it in comics form and you're talking about that stuff, you have to put it in the panel. And I'm trying as much as possible to put it in the panel, and that means I had to get my art, I think, up to a level where I was no longer as embarrassed by it. Because mm-hmm. my art's always been just so-so. I, you know, people who like my comics don't necessarily like it because they think it's, you know, brilliant art or anything like that. It's more the ideas that carried it. I think with making comics, I finally pushed it to the point where, okay, you know what, I can rest easy. This stuff does not look so bad anymore. And also, by pushing myself, you know, I also have more confidence to do my own work in the future.
Mm-hmm. Here at the Center of Podcast Studies, we know the dangers of podcasting and what you should avoid. Here's a sample.
All right, it works.
Yes, I got it back. I got every bit of it.
It's small, fast, does hex and block edits.
But oh, that's a good idea. I didn't think about that last time.
We're your geek morning show.
That's the thing about podcasts. We can be up anytime.
Don't listen to this while operating heavy machinery. You could spit out your water. I wonder what you'd get. Okay, I'm going to stop right there and make my comment.
Hey, wake me up when you're done.
I completely missed that one.
The writers of Back to the Future didn't see that one coming. Thanks, man. I had to think about that.
For your own research materials, visit chuckchat.com/technorama. Protect yourself.
This is Ronald D. Moore from Battlestar Galactica, and you're listening to Technorama.
Okay, I wanted to ask you about web comics. What, or I guess comics in general, what do you look for in a web comic that, or a comic rather, in general that really you enjoy? What kind of things do you look for?
Well, no, just but there's so many things. I mean, it depends. I look for different things, really. I look for variety. Mm-hmm. So you know, anything that appeals to me as being a great example of what it is. You know, any artist who just is who he or she is, full throttle, is doing something that's unique. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I can enjoy a James Kochalka, and I can enjoy a Chris Ware, and, you know, I can enjoy a good Kurt Busiek superhero comic. These are all very different things, but they're all, you know, what they are, mm-hmm. to a real great extent. So there's no one quality other than some form of distinctive voice, mm-hmm. and a real dedication to what they're doing. But I can read comics for a lot of different reasons. Mm-hmm. And I continue to look for things that expand the boundaries of the form.
So what do you think makes a good comic?
Well, same thing. I'm afraid it's a same answer, really. It's
I mean, like me personally, I think writing is probably one of the stronger things I look for, unless it's something, I've seen a couple that don't even use words, you know, just kind of, mm-hmm. a story, like the puppy, universe one that you showed.
Oh, yeah.
That one, that was kind of surreal. You were showing it. I was into it and I looked around, everybody was dead silent, the whole room. And you were just scrolling through it, and which was interesting. And there was no words or anything, not even you speaking. But I think pacing is probably one of the bigger things.
Well, sure. I mean, it's all part and parcel of comics. And, you know, you mentioned that writing is important to you. And, you know, one of the things that I showed with the strip you mentioned was Drew Wang's strip, Pup Ponders the Heat Death of the Universe, which,
right.
is this crazy web comic that came out a few years back. Even though it has very few words, they're still writing all the way through. Mm-hmm. You know, when we talk about writing in comics, we're not just talking about the use of the words. We're also talking about writing with pictures. And, you know, and everybody who's making comics is engaging in a form of writing. They're engaging in storytelling. And in comics, one of the beautiful things about comics is the way that we can communicate with pictures and communicate with words alternately. And whichever one we need to get the message across, we use. We don't worry about favoring one or the other necessarily. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you can be a writer, a successful writer of comics, and you can write, 30 straight pages where nobody speaks a word.
Right.
Still writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, moving along a little bit, I guess I want to talk about experimental comics. And the first time that I really seen an example of this is when you were on the Screensavers. This is a few years back. Well, several years back. What, 3, 4 years?
Might even be 5 by now.
Right. And I remember you were showing one, I think it was flash-based, and it was like rotating as you were clicking on the quadrant to go to. And I was just fascinated by that. And me being a little slow on the take-up, I was like, wow, this is cool. I've always been into computers and technology. I was like, well, maybe I should really start putting comics into this because I haven't really done any are on the web or anything other than my website. And but I wanted to make my comics as well. And I saw you talking about Experimental Comics. Can you kind of talk about maybe a little bit of where that's, I guess, for the web part, where that's kind of come from to a point?
Well, there are a lot of different kinds of experimental comics. There are a lot of experiments in comics. The one you mentioned, that clicking, zooming thing, was an early comic by a guy named Daniel Merlin Goodbury, who's off in London. His comics you can find at emerle.com. It's just the letter E followed by a hyphen, you know, dash, followed by M-E-R-L. And that was one of the things you'll get if you click on hypercomics. He has various hypercomics experiments. That was before he did his real masterpiece, which is this thing called POCOM UK 001, which is this totally incredible, crazy zooming, panning, crazy quilt comic, where you just dive in and out and move through all these conflicting paths and all. You know, it's not straight storytelling. Definitely, it's the whole point of it is to experiment with new forms. But there are other people who are doing different kinds of experiments. Some are experimenting with more simple storylines, but playing with the space between panels, something that we barely ever do in print because mm-hmm. we don't want to waste paper.
Sure.
Then others experiment with multimedia ideas, you know, sound and motion. Some of this stuff, I think, tends to be kind of what I think of as comics exit ramp. I mean, some of these experiments really just verge on turning comics into little animated films and whatnot. Nothing wrong with that, but at that point you're just talking about a different form. It's not really so much about comics anymore. And plenty of them are just going to be, you know, dead-end experiments that nobody really does anything. But a few of them may unlock some fundamental ideas about comics that point to new forms of storytelling for this new century. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to keep our eyes open and not be too quick to judge the usefulness of them. And I think guys like Merlin definitely have a line on something useful.
Yeah. And, you know, there was a point when I was looking at some of those, especially the really long ones. You've got some on your site, really long ones. And I was like, well, what if you wanted to make a book or something out of this? How would you do that? But then you showed some examples in your talk. You showed some examples in your talk where you had papers folding out. You know, have you done any of that, or do you know of anybody that's doing that kind of thing?
You could, well, most of the stuff that's just spatial, yeah, you could do it in print. I mean, if you have a 10,000-inch, you know, printer or something like that, I don't know that you necessarily want to. The fold-out stuff that you mentioned, that's like going back to pre-Columbian picture manuscripts. They did that sort of thing, those accordion-folded things. You know, that's not practical, obviously, to print mm-hmm. that stuff. But, you know, when I was first starting out doing the experimental stuff in webcomics, I think my first priority was to just try to look for those things that had never been done in print, that couldn't necessarily been done in print. Not because I wanted to create some kind of artificial barrier between the two, but because just that was the more interesting stuff. Mm-hmm. Just reproducing what had already been done in print, for me, just wasn't as interesting. I think over the years, sometimes I was misinterpreted as some kind of hostility towards print. It's a little weird because I've been working in print the whole time. I mean, I never stopped working in print. My next project's a graphic novel. I keep publishing these books. So obviously, I don't think that print's ideas have been exhausted or anything. But for me, the most exciting stuff is when you can create an effect with comics in a digital environment that you just can't find anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And that's why I continue to look for those, you know, experimenters out on the frontier who are really pushing those boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to change the subject a little bit here. I noticed you were an advocate for artist rights. Where is that taking you? Are you still active pursuing, like, are you doing anything in particular to pursue that?
Well, I've always have so many plates spinning. I don't know that I've done a whole lot just lately, but... now that actually comes from something in the around 1990, I think it was. I think somewhere around there, 89 maybe, 1990. So it's been a while. I mean, we're talking good 16, 17 years. I was part of a group of independent cartoonists who got together, and they were reacting to some problems with distribution at the time, and they had put together this thing, the Creative Manifesto, which I had trouble kind of making sense of, and I suggested something a little simpler, a creator's bill of rights, which is the idea behind which was that there were a few clear rights that we really shouldn't be signing away as mm-hmm. writers and artists in comics. You know, like the right to have control and benefit from characters that we created or series that we created entirely ourselves, that we shouldn't, you know, be expected to just sign those away forever the way that people like Siegel and Shuster did, the people who created Superman. And then just the rights of people who worked on those characters, you know, a place like Marvel and DC, just stuff that we take for granted these days, like getting your original art back. Mm-hmm. That hasn't always been the case. Or, you know, profiting from the work as it's sold in future editions, stuff like that. It's just basic stuff. You're having a lawyer in a meeting when you're negotiating a contract or whatever. You know, there were people who used to be thrown out of offices if they had lawyers with them. Well. So, you know, just basic civilized stuff. Mm-hmm. And I felt that was just more powerful than having a long, sort of complex, rambling, pseudo-legal manifesto-y sure. thing. It's just easier to understand. Mm-hmm. And that traveled to some extent. I don't know that it made a huge impact at the time, but I think it anticipated a lot of what came after with things like Image. Right after that, the Image creators came along. You know, a bunch of superstar artists at Marvel and DC, I think it was DC as well, decided to form their own company and break off on their own. And for a while, it really looked like creators' rights was just a done deal. And that, you know, those rights were pretty much guaranteed. But I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think today there are still plenty of predatory practices among companies trying to go for rights grabs and get maybe more than they're entitled to.
Well, there'll always be that.
There'll always be that. So it's good to keep your eye on basic rights like that.
And I guess the web's changed a lot of that as well, because I can self-publish or even like at Lulu.com or other sites, and there's nobody involved but me, myself, and I.
Oh, yeah. Self-publishing in the web, you've completely left that behind. Mm-hmm. So the only place where this really matters is if you're going to be signing a contract with somebody else to publish your work. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, if you're self-publishing or, you know, if you're doing print-on-demand for yourself or you're just putting it up on the web, that's a great way to bypass any of these issues. You can just forget about it. But the moment you sign your name on the dotted line with some quote-unquote publisher, you'll watch yourself.
Yeah. And my dad, he just self-published a couple of books. Mm-hmm. He was in Vietnam. He wrote a couple of books about that. I helped him self-publish it on Lulu. It's been fantastic because, you know, I helped him do the covers and everything, and all of a sudden you got this tangible book out of a Word document, which is fascinating. So I guess, do you have any thoughts about how self-publishing is going to help, whether it be comic artists or just writers or whatever?
Well, self-publishing now means print on demand, I think, for most mm-hmm. people, which is it's a step up. It's like self-publishing on steroids. Mm-hmm. And I think it helps tremendously because, you know, that the economies of scale really held down people who had ideas that were only, you know, perhaps suitable for a very small audience. You know, all really innovative good ideas start small. So you have to have a system that allows for those small starts. And there have been times, many times, in the history of publishing when nothing that couldn't come out of the gate with big numbers would succeed.
Right.
And I think that it lowers the barriers to entry to have the ability to print in very small numbers. Mm-hmm. Some artists may create a comic, print up just a few hundred copies, maybe just 100, and bring them to a small press show and just sell them on the spot. Mm-hmm. That's a great way to be seen. It's a great way to make connections. It's a great way to show that you're serious about your work. Mm-hmm. And I think more and more people will be doing that.
Now, of course, that would indicate that somebody wants to make a little money off their art, which a lot of people do. So coming from that, I know you've been a proponent for micropayments on like your website, and you have some stuff on your site that you accept micropayments for. How's that going, and maybe how's that moving along?
Well, that was an experiment. That was back, I don't know when we did that. Was it 2003 mm-hmm. something? You know, we gave it a shot. I don't think that my own experiment worked particularly well. I still kind of like the system that we used. There was a company called BitPass that had a good system. They kept it relatively simple. Probably not simple enough for most people, I guess, in the final analysis.
Right.
And my own comic was probably too much of a weird experimental thing. You know,
no.
I tried to do too many things at once. I wanted it to be formally innovative and an interesting, weird story. And then I'm using a new payment system, and I think that pretty much overwhelmed people's brain circuitry. So, you know, I wasn't able to pull it off myself. But I don't think that the idea of paid content is completely dead. Mm-hmm. I've never thought that there was any way to completely, you know, eliminate things like file sharing. I think that's pretty much here to stay.
Right.
People will be getting things for free one way or another, no matter what. But that doesn't mean that you can't have markets between willing sellers and willing buyers. It's one of the reasons we have an iTunes. So that story is not done yet. Mm-hmm. But I fought that fight for a while. You know, obviously I'm on the sidelines now. I don't consider myself even to be a player on that landscape right now. Others are trying out their models. I think some of the problems that I was hoping to avoid in webcomics specifically, in terms of people having to, you know, figure out a way to pay for bandwidth, mm-hmm. you know, and stuff like that. Some of those problems I think are here, and they are sort of distorting the market a little in ways that I think are regrettable. But nevertheless, we have hundreds, thousands of really innovative minds coming up with solutions. Mm-hmm.
And the landscape has changed as far as payment goes, especially in the last 4 years, you know, like PayPal, and, you know, things are a lot easier to pay for the technology is a little different to make payments than they were in 2003.
Well, it is to a degree, but I think primarily what people are going for now is just free content with merchandising, sponsorships, advertising, and the like.
And books, like we mentioned.
And books, yeah. It's a book collection, certainly. Nobody knows how many are actually able to make a real living at it and how many are just able to make lunch money. Mm-hmm. I worry that it may not be as big a number as some think, but we'll see. You know, when you have so many different innovative people trying to find a solution, I'm sure a solution will be found. Mm-hmm. And it's way too early to declare anything, you know, a done deal.
Sure.
Around the world, everyone's opening the bathroom doors to expose them.
Wash your hands before every email.
Yeah, Chuck DeMasi's the devil. I like it. Okay, it just feels tacked on. Have you used it, Chuck?
I'm weird. Sorry.
Go.
Go. Craig, I heard that. You were taking a drink and almost lost it. I'm going to get you sooner or later. We're going to hear all over the microphone.
You're right.
Chuck, you owe me a new microphone. Did I ask for this?
Hi, this is Grant Imahara from Mythbusters. And Myth Confirmed, you're listening to Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
Now, let's talk about technology a little bit. How I noticed your whole family has Macs.
Yeah.
It looks like.
You were Mac heads.
You're Mac heads. When I noticed you've used technology a lot in some of your creation. So how can you talk about that a little bit, like the tablets and whatever, what kind of software you're using, maybe just a little bit of the process?
Well, I guess as far as art creation goes, I'm pretty much found my perfect tool when I finally got my hands on a Cintiq, which is that tablet that Wacom makes. It's both a monitor and a...
Oh, yeah, my lust.
Yeah, and a tablet, right. It's unfortunately, it's not very cheap. I put off getting one for quite a while. I finally got one, a model that had been discontinued. I got it for just $1,900,
oh, wow.
Which is a good deal. These days, the only Cintiq I think that's available now for specifically for drawing, there's one for more utilitarian applications, it costs less. But the one that's available for drawing is like $2,500, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a lot of money.
It is.
Know, like most people, that's their budget for all technology for a couple of years. But I thought it was important to get. I had had hand strain problems where I lost about a year. In fact, one of the reasons I wasn't able to finish a lot of things that I was hoping to finish before the new book was because I'd had these hand strain issues. But when I got the Cintiq, they just virtually evaporated. Mm-hmm. So it's really good for that.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing I wish I had was a Mac tablet for the tour, because it would have been great to have that on the tour with us, to be able to sketch on the road and stuff like that. And
thanks, Jobs.
Yeah, to say, oh, it burns me up that they're just now introducing the mod book, and yeah. I'm sure it won't really be. I don't think it's actually on the market yet. I think it's just one of those prototype announcements. Or
I think they said a few weeks that it would show.
Really, a few weeks? Oh, who knows? Maybe I will get myself one if we can afford it. That's like $2,200, so that might be a little bit much.
Hey, if you want to sell the tablet, give me a call.
Yeah, sell the Cintiq. That's it. I should sell the Cintiq.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I may do that. Unless, of course, there's somebody from Apple listening to this podcast, in which case, great promotional opportunity, people.
Yep, that's right.
Wouldn't mind a mod book. Oh, it's the perfect tool for me. You know, it's like that's Alan Kay's magic slate right there, going all the way back to, I think it was Alan Kay, like Xerox PARC days.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the idea of that, just that perfect slate. But that's, I think, many cartoonists' perfect tool. It's something portable, something you just put on your lap and just draw. Just go out in your backyard and draw to your heart's content. That would be absolutely magnificent.
Now, I'm a fan of Scott Kurtz, and he switched over to digital only. And it was like about a week where you could almost tell, and then now it looks so much like it did before that I doubt you could tell whether he did it with pen and pencil or not. And I think that's pretty amazing.
Well, the important thing when you have a cartoonist like Kurtz, who, you know, has the brains to put that superstructure of storytelling and pacing and character design underneath everything, it doesn't matter what tools you use. You know, he could probably do it with a stick and some chocolate pudding.
Some mud and a stick.
Yeah, it's the thought behind it, you know, that matters. And that's true of a lot of great cartoonists. And there are people who are slaves to their tools, and there are people who are masters of their tools. In the end, the tool matters a lot less than the thought behind it. And that's, you know, I'm trying to get to that point, too, where the tool doesn't matter. I think my tools were getting the better of me when I did my second book about comics, Reinventing Comics, where I just, you know, I'd gotten a Wacom tablet just a short time before that, and I was still wobbly on it, and it wasn't necessarily the right tool for the job and everything. Whereas with the latest book, with Making Comics, I had the Cintiq. I was a lot more seasoned, a lot more comfortable with the software, and I think there it's more of a comfortable job. And in the end, the tools served the work more than the other way around.
Yeah, I bought one of the $100 Wacom, which it's good, but it's tough to draw on, you know. But the reason I bought it, you were talking about your hand strain. Mm-hmm. I was starting to get carpal tunnel because I type all the day. I'm a web developer. And I convinced my boss, let me try one of the tablets. So I bought a tablet, and just the change, instead of grabbing the mouse, holding a pen was much more natural. And within a few months, it took care of my problem.
Yeah, it's a lot better than the clicking around.
Oh, yeah.
But I found for me, even with the Wacom, it was better to do the Cintiq because it was more like drawing. I was drawing with my forearm rather than my wrist, basically, was the big difference. I think my first big mistake, though, back in the day, even before the Wacom tablet, was getting one of those four-button mouses, which sounds like a great idea at the time because you think how much more productive you'll be. Mm-hmm. But then all of a sudden your fingers are just going clickety, clickety, clickety all day long.
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's see. I wanted to, we talked about comic rights. Oh, yeah. So what's in the future for you, Scott? What you got coming up down the pipe?
I got a pretty simple roadmap for me. I got this tour to finish. We finish up in August. I'll probably have a couple of months of cleanup while we do, you know, one or two schools that weren't in session or whatever.
I thought you meant the van, cleaning up the van.
Yeah, oh, yeah, no, I mean, yeah, literally. No, we're going to literally clean up the van, but then also, clean up from our storage. All our stuff is in storage, you know, we got to find an apartment, figure out where we want to live, all that sort of thing, putting our lives together. And then I have a graphic novel that I want to do. We want to pitch that, make sure I get enough of an advance that I can just sit in a studio and draw for 3 years. Because it's going to take a long time. It's going to be 300 or 400 pages of pure comics, pretty labor-intensive stuff. It's fiction. Mm-hmm. It's a story I've had in mind for 20 years.
Oh, fantastic.
Well, I look forward to that. Well, be sure to let me know, you know, when that's ready to come out.
I'll try to let everybody know.
That's right.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about your trip? Because I know did you sell your house?
No, we didn't even have. We've always rented. We were living in Southern California. And I kept saying, no, let's wait. The prices are too high. This is ridiculous. Let's wait till they come down. This is like in the mid-90s, right?
Right. Yeah. It's only gotten better, right?
Right? Going up, going up, going up. I was an idiot. I should have realized. The thing I've understood now, because this is true of the stock market too, is that at that point where I know that it's overvalued, that it couldn't possibly go any higher, I should buy. because even though I'm right that it'll crash, nobody else will realize it for at least 3 years, and
okay.
I can make a real killing.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Because if we had bought a house in Southern California in like 2001, we could just be living off of the difference at this point. If we had sold in 2000, early 2006, because it's starting to go soft. But no, we've always been renting, and I think my wife and I just feel like we're destined to be gypsies, and always go from place to place to place. I think when the kids are grown and gone to college, I think that Ivy and I might just never settle down anywhere. Just keep moving, you know, live in Alaska for a couple of years, you know, live in Minneapolis, go to Hawaii, maybe go to London. She'd love to live in London for a while.
See, my wife, she's big on traveling, and she's been to Alaska and everything before we got married. But we went on some really good trips ourselves, and when I was telling her about, oh, this guy named Scott McCloud, she doesn't know, you know, I'm like, this guy's Scott McCloud. Him and his family, they went, you know, they're going on this tour, all 50 states, and she's like, when are you writing a book?
actually, I think my 13-year-old daughter may be writing a book about this tour. We'll see.
Oh, wow. There you go.
So what's it been like for all four of y'all being crammed in the van? I know at times it's got to be a little stressful, right?
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, you know, we're an actual family. Mm-hmm. You know, I know it seems hard to believe, but, you know, like
it's not like you're four strangers being crammed in a van.
Exactly, yeah. We're like any family. Of course, mm-hmm. You know, we fight like cats and dogs some days, and some days we get along great. But, you know, we're pretty functional. We're a pretty sociable family. And we're real nerds. So we just, you know, for a certain chunk of time, we just spend it with our faces buried in the computer screen. You know, everybody. We got our daughters both have laptops because I know it's kind of an extravagance, but, you know, they don't have bedrooms.
Right.
So this is their bedroom. You know, this is their private space. And it gives them both a chance to just go and hide if they need to, you know, being in such close quarters for an entire year is,
sure,
you know, that's asking them, a lot of them.
And that makes a lot of sense, you know, because at least that's a little bit of privacy.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And my older daughter especially is doing a lot of video editing, and she does her PowerPoint presentations on it and blogs a lot and is doing these photo comics and, you know, writing poems and whatnot. So she's getting a lot of use out of her machine, as are we all. But that's worked out pretty well. And we're just a really wired family. When we went to the Apple store in New York City on 58th Street, this is that giant glass cube.
Oh, yeah, the awesome-looking store.
Right, yeah. This is the one with the giant glowing white Apple logo, and you have to go down to the subterranean lair, and it's never closed even on Christmas and New Year's because there are no locks on the door. There's no doors, really. You just go down. Yeah, so it's always open 24 hours a day.
Okay.
I went there, and I brought in, we had a problem with my younger daughter's laptop, and we had to have it fixed, and he waived the fee on one of the repairs, and I said, thanks very much. He said, oh, it's nothing. Don't worry. You know, you guys are our perfect customers. Of everybody who comes in this store, okay, and this is like ground zero from Apple, right?
Yeah.
Everybody who comes in this store, you are the most hardcore users of our products of anybody I've ever seen.
They have your picture up in the back?
I think they might soon, yeah.
That's pretty cool. So, well, let me ask you this, talking about Apples. What skews you more towards using Macs than the other?
Well, and, you know, I've used PCs somewhat. Mm-hmm. I can't say that I've used PCs enough to have made a completely fair comparison. But every time I have, it has not dimmed my enthusiasm for the Mac. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my daughter, Skye, is 13, and she has the, you know, fervent religious devotion to Macs. And even when things go wrong and you'd think she would curse the name, she actually still is very, very loyal to the platform. And I guess I am too at this point. It's just a thing of beauty. I really like the design.
Sure.
You know, occasionally there'll be a decision that I don't like so much. But, you know, in the very early days of the user interface, of the graphic user interface, you know, revolution, this post-Xerox PARC, I guess in the early 80s, mid-80s, when there was still, when, you know, PCs mostly were command line interfaces and whatnot. There were two meanings of the idea of transparency. I think that there was, on the one hand, there were those who hated things like the Mac because it obscured what they saw as the transparency between themselves and the machine. Mm-hmm. They wanted to know what was going on under the hood.
Sure.
They wanted to get right down and see exactly what was happening in the code. But from the from the graphic user standpoint, they want a transparency between the user and the work. And that's what I think the graphic user interface presented for us. And I think to this day, I just find that I can go straight from me to my work, and the computer just doesn't get in the way.
Right.
And that's what I still like about the Macs. And I still find that when I have to be stuck on a Windows machine for any length of time, not often, but you know, occasionally, I still feel like, no, there's still this barrier.
Mm-hmm. And that's how I feel. I got a MacBook Pro, and I feel like the same thing, but at the same time, I can get my hands dirty with whatever you want, but at the same time, that's kind of disconnected. So
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to talk about? I think I pretty much covered.
No, I guess all that's left is just if you want to check out the 50-state tour, go ahead, scottmcleod.com, and click on the little cartoon of the gray Toyota Sienna with my wife with the purple hair driving and me sticking out of the sunroof drawing.
Yeah, there you go.
And I'll take you straight to the tour page and with a little link for the tour blog if you'd like to follow that.
Okay, and I'll have links for all that in the show notes and all that good stuff. So,
Dynamite.
Oh, by the way, I personally liked the Hulk movie.
It had its virtues.
It did.
At the very worst, it was a noble failure, mm-hmm. but it was noble.
Yeah, when you mentioned that, I was like, this is the same conversation me and my brother-in-law have had. We went to see it together. He's like, oh, yeah, the Hulk. We're so there. We went to go see it. And I really liked it because when I thought they worked the panels well when they slid the panels in. And you saw, like, somebody was walking. And you saw their back. And then you saw them approaching and saw the other person they're going to. And I thought that kind of worked to a point, but you made a good point, which I hadn't thought about. It did kind of disconnect you from the story itself a little bit.
Yeah, it kind of yanked you out, but yeah. I still like Ang Lee. He's a cool filmmaker.
Oh, yeah, Crouching Tiger.
Oh, Dynamite. Can't get better than that.
All right, well, there you go. I thank you, Scott, for joining me, and certainly appreciate your time.
Thank you, Craig.
Well, there you have it. There's our interview with Scott McLeod. I want to thank Scott for spending some time with us. And I got to hold up his family. They were trying to leave out of town to head on to the next stop, and I do appreciate their patience. So if you like this interview and you want to hear some more, head on over to chuckchat.com/technorama. There's a link to all of our interviews that we've posted in the past. And don't forget, this is not a normal show, so be sure to subscribe while you're there, and you can get the regular show downloaded for you automatically. This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech at friendsintech.com. And to everybody, a binary high five, 101.